Over the last 2 days, Inclusive Sport SA has been holding its annual Inclusion and Diversity in Sport conference, exploring how sporting communities at the grassroots and professional levels can be more inclusive and welcoming of people with diverse needs and experiences. Eric Dennison spoke at today's session. He's a PhD researcher with Monash University's Behavioural Studies program, with a special focus on the underlying causes of homophobic behaviour in sport. He joined me for a chat about the program, as well as Out on the Fields, a study he was the lead researcher for and which was the first international study on homophobia in sport.
The Behavioural Studies program is one of three departments or institutes within Monash that researches social problems and uses a behavioral change methodology to try and develop solutions and then test those solutions. And so my specific area is LGBTI inclusion in sport, but there's others who look at the alcohol consumption and how we can change alcohol consumption patterns. There's also people look at sustainability, so how we can get people to recycle more, how we can get people to use less water. There's terrorism, how to reduce terrorist behavior, both here and overseas. So quite a few social issues, and it all has its roots in human behavior in terms of trying to change or understand human behavior.
That sounds very interesting. How was it decided that a focus would be put on LGBTIQ plus people's experiences in sport, in communities, and, you know, in kind of on the big stage as well?
Yeah, and I'm purposely using LGBTI because we're a university, we're apolitical, and so we're going for basically the scientific identifiers of the community. I know it is customary to use LGBTIQ, which is GLAAD, which is a large organization in America, but I'll use LGBTI. So in terms of LGBTI community, there's just a really strong need from industry. I mean, all the major sports in Australia have committed to eliminate homophobia specifically, and they've also recently committed to eliminate transphobia. So now it's about, how do you do that? And that's the big million-dollar question. It's never been researched anywhere else in the world. And so we need to first understand the behavioral underpinnings of why people act in a homophobic way in sport. My specific area is in male sport, and we'll have two other researchers looking at female sport and trans sport. But then it's about developing interventions, programs, educational tools that will then change that behavior, testing to see if it actually works, and then sharing the results with the rest of the world, because it's not just Australia that struggles with homophobia and transphobia in sport. The entire world struggles with it. And I was previously the lead investigator and lead author of the Out on the Field study, which is the largest study done on homophobia in sport and the first international study with nearly 10,000 participants. And we found that 80% of people had witnessed or experienced homophobia in sport, and the most common form was slurs and sledges. And the vast majority of people said homophobia is far more common in sport than the rest of society in their countries. And we looked at the six major English-speaking countries, so Australia, Canada, United States, UK, that kind of thing.
And I suppose when you do this research, there's always the risk that people may not be honest in the answers that they give, because they may still feel some shame, you know, in regards to who they are or what they've experienced, even the shame in telling their story and the kinds of discrimination they face.
I mean, I think we have a lot of tools in academia to get around that honesty question. That's called bias in academia. And we know bias exists, that people will be less or more likely to share information with you depending on the setting, the way the question's asked, where they're asked the question, how they're asked the question. But we have a lot of ways to mitigate that effect. So I think the honesty factor is less of a concern. It's more around getting large enough, because if you have a large enough sample, any issues around individual honesty takes that biasing effect out, or at least it should, or it does to a large degree. So I think with this particular issue, the biggest question will be, are we actually changing behavior? Because changing attitudes and changing beliefs is not the same thing as changing behavior. And often people can be very pro-gay, but still, in the sporting context, when they're in the locker room, they're either silent bystanders when there's homophobic jokes being made, or they engage in it because they have some insecurities which trumps their support of being supportive gay people. And that need to feel top dog in a locker room, feel accepted one of the boys actually motivates the homophobic behavior. So humans are complicated people. We're complicated, but also a lot of the times what we find is what we intuitively think will work doesn't actually work. And so we really need to tease things out and use a lot of existing evidence, particularly in social psychology, to understand what has worked in the past and build from that, rather than really trying to recreate the wheel using, you know, best intentions. Because unfortunately, when it comes to human behavior, humans are not rational, and best intentions rarely work. So it comes down to really understanding just how humans tick. And we've thankfully in the last 5-10 years gained a lot of knowledge in that space, and we can develop the interventions, as we call them in academia, the essentially education programs or tools, or even, you know, to be honest, wearing a seatbelt or getting people to wear seatbelts and educating them through television ads, that's an intervention in academia. So really it's just about how do we get people to behave in a certain way.
One of the interesting things that you mentioned in your address today was that when you did carry out the survey and were seeking out participants, you didn't go through service organisations because of their connections that they already had with LGBTI people. And it makes so much sense to try and get a broader cross-section of the community.
Yeah, it's really important in research when you are getting a convenience sample, which is basically people who are there and are available to you, but also through self-selection, which means I've decided to take part in this because I've read about it somewhere, a friend's told me about it, that kind of thing, to go as broad as possible. In previous research on LGBTI issues generally, but specifically on sport, has often been promoted in terms of the recruitment of participants only through LGBTI organizations, only through, you know, LGBTI charities, through the LGBTI media, and you're really getting a fairly niche, potentially not representative sample at all, because it's people who are actually engaged and active and connected to that community. So really you want to get a broad range of people who are not necessarily engaged in that community, who may be in the closet, may just choose not to be accepted in the community. And that's what was the power with using and working with the major sports and using their social media channels and using a lot of their athletes to help promote the study. So that really encouraged a lot of people to take part. The downside of that is, and we had a bit of a lot of fear, that anytime that the major sports promote LGBTI issues to their social media channels, some less than others, but there's a lot of homophobic comments. And we thought potentially that a lot of those people who generally make homophobic comments would be quite motivated to take part in the research and skew the results. What was interesting for us then, once we crunched all the numbers, was then to compare the responses from the straight people to the gay people. Surprisingly, even with these potential foils who would be quite motivated to try and foil the research, there wasn't much of a difference. There was some, in some areas, there was a major difference, particularly around whether people thought homophobia was, you know, more common or less common. But on a lot of things, particularly youth sport, there's unanimous agreement that youth sport is not a safe place for LGBTI people.
Why was that, do you think?
I think when you're doing research and when you're actually doing a survey and, you know, you're collecting data and you're taking part, that kind of thing, people tend to be more honest than they set out to be. And maybe it's their conscience comes into play. And I'm just hypothesizing here, but I think potentially that question can't be answered any other way. That it's just unanimous agreement. Well, of course, you know, there's no openly gay people in youth sport, or very few. There's a lot more in female sport, but even in female sport, there's not as many as you think, you know. And I have a number of friends who are female athletes, and they say around half their team is lesbian, but only a small portion of them are actually open about their sexuality. So with everyone, or even the majority of the team. So I think it's, you know, we still struggle in both male and female sport with this issue around homophobia and acceptance. And it's almost like sport really is the last frontier in many ways of homophobia in Western society. It's sort of the last pocket where homophobia and to some degree transphobia is not only accepted, but it's just normal.
Another part of the research was in regards to participation rates between men and women, and it definitely helps to challenge constructions of who participates in what sport depending on their sexuality?
Yeah, there's this stereotype that gay men only play individualized sport, or maybe they play more feminized sport like netball. They can't play the rough and tumble sports like AFL and rugby and, you know, the more masculine sports like soccer, or that lesbians only play those sports. They don't play the more feminized sports like netball. And our research didn't find that at all. It found the exact opposite, that there's a lot of lesbians playing the more feminized sports like volleyball and netball, and a lot of gay guys are playing the tough sports like AFL and rugby. So that really threw things on its head for us, and I think potentially for researchers down the track as well, in terms of understanding where are the gay and lesbian people? What sports are they playing? How do we reach them? How do we protect them? How do we get them to come out or feel safe coming out? Which sports do we work with? So I think it almost in some ways made the job a little bit harder, because it showed that there's not a single sport that's being played in Australia or overseas where there isn't a large percentage of LGBT people, well, LGB for sure, and potentially transgender people, who are playing that sport and are just staying in the closet.
How has that research been used now that, for example, that research has been completed? And I suppose, where are you at currently with the work that you're doing at Monash?
Yeah, so the next step, so that was kind of proving the problem, because there had been research done in the past that had found high rates of homophobia in sport, nothing as large as the out in the field study. So that at least set the groundwork, and nothing of the same quality as well in terms of the approach to recruitment, getting a very diverse and wide-ranging sample of people to take part in the study. So the next step now is, now that we know that there's a problem, all the sports have said, well, we've got to do something about it. Unfortunately, dealing with LGBTI issues in sport, there's a current research project that we're doing at Monash and in partnership with other universities. LGBTI issues are very low priority for sporting organizations. It's often not even dealt with at all. So really it's about, there are organizations that want to do stuff, and we need to help them with some evidence so that they have limited resources so that they can use evidence-based recommendations for developing programs. So that's where we're at now. They're happy to do something. They don't want to put a lot of resources into it. They want to make sure it works. So we're helping them by giving them the evidence of what can work and what can't.
Yeah, well, at least they're kind of willing to participate, seeing as it's such a widespread problem, and there would be people in their clubs who simply don't want to share their experience with team management or with their teammates.
Yeah, it was interesting because the conference that we're at today, the head of the conference made an interesting point. And, you know, I thought to myself, I wonder if I'll raise this specifically. But it really is a life or death issue for LGBTI inclusion in sport, because we know there's a strong correlation between experiencing homophobic language, homophobic physical abuse, and high rates of self-harm, suicide. So we know there's a correlation. We know specifically in sport that homophobia in sport causes depression and anxiety and has a detrimental effect on gay people's mental health. So it really is life or death. It's not just about making sure people have the access to, you know, a healthy lifestyle. It purely is, these people are experiencing discrimination and we need to do something about it because it's potentially killing them.
On a more personal level, what has it meant to you to be part of research like this? That's quite significant.
Yeah, so my story began in high school when I played rugby, and it quickly became apparent that, and I had played sport basically my entire life before that, but it quickly became apparent that I was not like all the other boys. And I wasn't really sure what that meant or why that was, but I just knew that I wasn't one of them. I couldn't talk about girls the way they were. I didn't have the same interests, or at least pretended to have, you know, I couldn't pretend to have the interest. So I drifted off of rugby and started playing soccer again, which is what I played when I was younger. And then in high school, word got out that I was gay. One of my friends, you know, quote unquote, accidentally told everyone in the school. And it was like it was an instant change. I went from, you know, being Mr. Popular to Mr. Non-Person almost overnight. So that was a long time ago now. It was nearly 25 years ago. And I thought things, I think like a lot of people, had changed dramatically since then. And I only became interested in this research when I helped organize the World Cup of Gay Rugby in Sydney. And we kept being asked by the media, so why do you need an event like this, and how, you know, widespread is homophobia? And we didn't have the answer, really. So that started my interest in the research. I'm kind of an accidental academic. We did the research. I was shocked. Everyone was shocked by the findings. And because I was quite alarmed by the high rates of homophobia that still exists in sport, I wanted to do something about it. So that's why I became involved in the Monash Project and why I'm managing the Monash Project.
And I suppose it helped you to also realise that you weren't alone in your experiences. Even though it is shocking to see results like this, it's also kind of heartening to know that you're not alone.
Yeah, the whole process is quite therapeutic because you have these experiences of homophobic abuse when you're young, and being able to actually do something about it to hopefully help future generations and use good evidence to do something about it, I think is quite therapeutic. It's quite healing from the earlier journey. And it's great to work. Monash is a great university because it's one of the top universities in the world, but it has really passionate academics who are interested in issues like this. And so it's interesting working with them. And you know, everyone else involved in the program is straight. I'm the only gay person. So that's interesting, hearing their perspectives and approaches. But everyone has the same view. It's like, we've got to fix this. This is, you know, it's been going on too long. We shouldn't be living in a world where 80% of people have witnessed or experienced homophobia in sport. That's ridiculous. You know, if we talked about, you know, 80% of people had witnessed racism in sport, we'd never say that. We would, you know, sport would be banned if that was, you know, as one Guardian reporter said. So, you know, we're in this weird world where this is just normal, and, you know, hopefully we can help change this behavior.
Eric Dennison, PhD researcher with Monash University's Behavioural Studies Program and a speaker at today's Inclusion and Diversity in Sport conference.